This is Fresh Air. The old suburban dream didn't include traffic gridlock, nor did Americans move to the suburbs in the hopes of breathing polluted air, witnessing the loss of open space, and participating in general environmental degradation. Some of the post-World War II suburbs have become dysfunctional. My guest Peter Calthorpe is designing new alternative communities. Calthorpe is an architect who was named by Newsweek as one of the 25 innovators on the cutting edge. He's the author of the new book, The Next American Metropolis: Ecology, Community, and the American Dream. He says the old suburban dream is out of sync with today's culture. How is it out of sync?
Well, I think in many, many ways. You can look at it from a kind of economist standpoint in which we can no longer afford it. I don't think we can afford it in environmental terms. We can't seem to afford it. Government can't afford to deliver the infrastructure that seems to be necessary to sustain it, the road systems and the water systems, et cetera. And in a very profound way, the average middle income household doesn't seem to be able to afford it any longer. We watch people in California and other metropolitan areas sacrificing major portions of their day just to be able to get around in order to be able to still purchase that single family dwelling. But beyond the cost implications, I think that there's a social dilemma, which is that the demographics of America have changed. You know, we're only about a quarter the nuclear family today. Ozzie and Harriet and two kids really represent one out of four households now.
That's really low.
Yeah. It astounds most people, and yet that's the reality of the situation, 1990 census. So we seem to have an urban pattern built on a post-World War II image, which is the nuclear family in the suburban landscape, which no longer fits who we really are, how diverse we are in terms of age, single people, single parents are on the rise, elderly percentage of our population is on the rise. And when you think about it, a lot of these groups really don't fit the mold when you think about a large home on a large lot in a distant location.
So the houses aren't designed for how we're living today, and the locations aren't right for how we're living today either.
Well, it's almost more than the house. It is more the location or the kind of community is what it really comes down to. You think even of the nuclear family, now there's two workers there. So all of a sudden the kids are coming home alone. They're at the end of a cul-de-sac somewhere. They can't get anywhere by themselves because all roads lead to an arterial, which, of course, is not a place you let a 10-year-old out. And the kids tend to be stranded. Now, a lot of people think that it's good to be there because it's safe, but that doesn't seem to be increasingly the case. There was a very interesting study done of kids, 10-year-old kids in a small Vermont town versus same age group in Orange County suburb. Now, the Orange County suburb is where you go, of course, if you're wealthy and you have you're fulfilling the American dream. But it turns out those kids in the Vermont town had three times the mobility. They could get around on their own. They could experience the world. They could kind of mature in a way with some autonomy. They didn't have to be chauffeured everywhere. But the really startling dimension of that study showed that those kids in Orange County watched four times more television.
One of the models you've come up with as an alternative to the suburb is something you describe as the pedestrian pocket. Would you describe that for us?
Well, it's an old idea, but it's something that is being formulated so it works with our contemporary culture. And it really is the idea of a more integrated, mixed-use neighborhood that's walkable. So that the fundamental principles are that you have diverse housing opportunities. You don't just have the monotony of a series of single-family subdivisions. You try to provide places for a broad spectrum of people. You do it in a framework, a street system that's pleasant to walk along. And the implications are really quite pleasing. It's and maybe nostalgic. Some people call it kitsch. I just think it's kind of fundamental. It leads to things like front porches again, so that when you walk down a street, you see your neighbors. It's safer. It's kind of practical. And lo and behold, it turns out that's kind of what everybody wants anyway. Anyway, that diverse housing gets integrated into communities that have shopping and have recreation and have schools and have jobs, all within a reasonable walking distance. Now, that's not to say that people are going to live and work in the same neighborhood and that we're going to kind of balkanize ourselves down to back to a feudal state. Because the way it really can work is when you link a series of these walkable neighborhoods or pedestrian pockets with transit, it becomes viable for people to use it. And people are going to do whatever's most convenient. And the degree to which the car and its expense and the congestion become less and less convenient is the degree to which they need choices, which unfortunately they don't have.
If you were building a new town from scratch, what kind of public spaces would you want in it?
Well, you have to have a whole range. I mean, first you have to preserve the most sensitive habitat and natural features. You have to let the nature that exists in a region coexist with the human development. And I think that's fundamental, and there's no reason we can't do it. As a matter of fact, the most beautiful places in the world all do that, and that's why people like to be there. So the first type of open space would be natural open space. Then I think you need, jumping all the way down to the neighborhood scale, you need small neighborhood parks that are close enough for kids to walk to again. Because of a false efficiency, we've tended now to build parks larger and larger and more distant, which make them, once again, another auto trip away from home. And also, they become so large that they actually become a little dangerous. So we're for smaller parks, more evenly distributed among the neighborhoods, which can become like a community focus. Another thing that we tend to do in our work is bring back the old village green, which is a tradition in American town planning since we first settled here. Obviously, it's a tradition that goes back to Europe. But a place, an open space at the heart of the community where the housing and the commercial and the civic uses come back together again. And when you do that, all of a sudden you begin to get an identity that's a little stronger than your local shopping center. And it has to do with recombining the commercial world and the civic world. I think when you do that, people begin to get a sense of place again that's been lost in the that landscape of segregated uses that we seem to have evolved to.
Architect Peter Calthorpe is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Peter Calthorpe is my guest. He's an architect based in the San Francisco Bay Area and the author of the new book, The Next American Metropolis, Ecology, Community, and the American Dream. What is the area that you've worked on that you've been most satisfied with so far?
That's a good question. Well, one project, which is we're working on for 1,000 Friends of Oregon, which is an environmental group up in Portland. You know, Portland has been one of the most progressive areas in the country in terms of land planning. Back in the 70s, the state created some legislation that set urban growth boundaries. So Portland's been living within a line so that it doesn't sprawl out too far. And the 1,000 Friends, a very progressive environmental group that actually deals with issues beyond environmentalism, have been a big part of that, and also have tried to be the guardian of those principles. Well, the Department of Transportation in Oregon came along and said, well, the city needs a new beltway, you know, another freeway out at the fringe to handle the next generation's growth in that city. 1,000 Friends looked at that and realized that would cause sprawl well outside of the urban growth boundary. So they asked us to look at and do a feasibility study to show whether or not we could accommodate all the growth within the urban growth boundary and organize it around the new light rail, which they'd already paid for. It was going into that section of the city. Organize that new growth around the transit system so that a new freeway would not be needed. And we were able to show that it was, number one, quite easy to fit the growth within the boundary. Number two, that it could be organized into more walkable and transit-oriented neighborhoods. And number three, if that happened, that people would typically use transit more and use their cars less, and the need for a new freeway would go away. So it was a project at a fairly grand scale, but it sketched out a big future and two self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, if you build the freeway, you will get the sprawl, and therefore you will need the freeway to handle all the cars. If you don't, and you organize the growth around the transit system, then the transit system becomes effective. and you don't need the expense or the environmental degradation of the increased highway system.
What kind of resistance are you usually up against when you're trying to implement one of your ideas?
Lots. I mean, the inertia of the status quo is really quite profound, and people's fear of change, even if it's in a way back to something very familiar, is always present. There is the sense among neighborhood groups now, because development has been so repugnant for so long, that any development is bad, period. And so that, of course, just forces development farther out into the fringes where there aren't neighborhood groups to oppose it. So rather than kind of taking it in and trying to cope with it coherently, as these communities reject it, they actually create more problems. So that's one of the issues, is we call it NIMBYism, not in my backyard. We don't want transit here. We don't want a mix of housing types, because that brings people that are different from us. We don't want, in many cases they say, we don't even want stores, because in their minds that just means traffic. So there's a lot of that that goes on. Then there's also the development community, which is very slow to take risks, especially in this kind of post-80s, post-SNL crisis world, where they got burned by going too far in the wrong direction, and they're not about to take a risk on anything that's outside of the standard formula. The list goes on, I'm sad to say. You know, there's the traffic engineers who have really been in control of our public environment. You know, it used to be that we had great designers that would think about the quality of public space first. You know, the identity, the character, the grandeur of the parks or the plazas or the monuments or even the simple thing of a beautiful streetscape. And now, largely, I'd say the public domain has been handed over to traffic engineers, whose primary interest is how do you move cars efficiently and quickly. And, you know, anybody can walk out onto any street outside of an older urban neighborhood and find themselves in an environment that's really designed for the car rather than for people.
Well, here's an important question. Where does the shopping mall fit in your vision?
Well, this is where things get complicated. We have a new order of retail. We don't have mom and pop shops anymore. And as much as we kind of would love to fantasize about bringing them back, we can't. I do think it's possible, and this just takes design finesse, and it's part of what is most interesting about this field, is trying to find hybrids and trying to create a world that's both convenient to the car and to the pedestrian. But you have to find a hybrid that allows those larger stores to exist, but also find a way to knit them into a neighborhood so they become more than just, a destination along a highway.
Are you able to live in a community now that suits the ideals that you discuss?
You know, I find it interesting that the communities that come closest to the ideals are actually, unfortunately, because there's so few of them now, they're becoming the most expensive places.
Exactly.
They're certainly desirable to live in a neighborhood where you don't have to be on an arterial every time you want to go somewhere. But they tend to be the older, smaller towns, which in the end is where people tend to be gravitating, or the urban centers, the higher quality urban centers.
So do you live in one of those?
Now, I live in Berkeley now, which has a lot of those qualities once again.
Uh-huh.
A mix of housing, mix of, income groups and household types and easy access to lots of different things just down the street.
What do you think
You know, it's really a pattern. This suburban pattern is really only 40 years old. This is what we have to remember. I mean, mankind has thousands and thousands of years of urban history, and only in the last 40 years have we created a physical environment totally dependent on the car.
So it's not too late to try to change it, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm trying to point. Hey, this is a small experiment that needs some serious adjustment.
Peter Calthorpe, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Calthorpe is the author of the new book, The Next American Metropolis. His firm, Calthorpe Associates, is in the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Fresh Air.